Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show, hosted by author, investor, money partner, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, this is Bruce Norris. Welcome to our show. Today we're honored to have Alan Nevin. He's the Director of Economic Research for Market Point Realty Advisors, which also puts them in position of being the Chief Economist for the California Builders Association. Alan, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Alan, it sounds like your job titles have a lot of responsibility attached to them. Can you give me an idea of what would be your main job as Director of the Economic Research for Market Point?
Most of my work relates to working with real estate developers, helping them to determine the appropriate product to build.
That's both residential and commercial?
Yes.
Okay. What would you be telling them in 2007 that you probably wouldn't have been saying in 2005? Just curious.
Well, actually, 2005, we already saw the change in the market, the residential market, occurring. We can pretty much trace the, let us say, the turnaround in the California market to about June or July 2005.
Okay.
So that we already could see it in formation, the downturn in formation. And it really related to a couple of factors. One is a reduction in traffic. The second would be the large number of investors who were starting to get skittish about buying properties. And the third is there was worry at that point in time about the economy in general turning down. It didn't happen, but nonetheless, it was widely ballyhooed in the press.
Do you think just the rumor that that might occur hurt the real estate market?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, the entirety of the craziness of 2004, 2005 really related to the investors being in the market. When you take the investors out of the market, it was a fairly normative market. But particularly on the condominium side, you saw 30 to 40% of units being bought by investors, and that was just not a tolerable situation, nor a sustainable one.
Okay. I know that in 2004 you had said that the current rate of appreciation would be unsustainable, and that turned out to definitely be true.
Yeah.
In September 2005, in a seminar, you stated that the current 5 to 6% appreciation gets the investors out of the market. So do you view the investors getting out of the market a sign that we'll someday soon turn to a healthy market, or is there too much overhang for that to happen very quickly?
Well, they're out of the market, and they are trying to void themselves of property.
Correct.
And that is causing a major part of the softness, particularly in the condominium market, because a large number of them bought in large projects, and you wind up with a situation where you have an abnormal number of units on the market at one time, which is not healthy.
No. Would it be fair to describe these people as investors, or should we put the tag speculators to them?
Well, they really divide into three parts. The first one is the investor who buys and will hold for some rational period of time. They're not in for the quick buck.
Okay.
The second category is the, I guess what's become known as the flipper, the guy who wants to take a quick buck, turn their unit. And then the third is, we'll call them second home buyers, but when they buy that second home, they lease it out.
Okay.
So they, if theoretically, they're buying as an owner-occupant, but very often just don't occupy.
I see. They're going to be there for a little while, but not all year.
You know, the stories that you hear typically is I'm buying when my kid gets out of college, or stories like that. But the reality is they are investors.
Okay. Now, this investor or speculator, has he shown up every time in every one of these cycles? So why is this different, I guess my question is?
This was an entirely different situation. This was just highly unusual. It's a combination of a generally good real estate market, low interest rates, and an abnormal amount of available equity. And you not only see it on the small investor, you obviously see it in the international market in terms of an enormous number of dollars going into projects that are not terribly rational.
Between 2000 and, say, 2 to 2005, did real estate have any competitor when it came to investing? Because if you had dollars to spend, it would seem to me that you probably sent it toward real estate as opposed to fixed-rate instruments or bonds or the stock market.
It's sort of interesting that during that wild period of real estate in 2004, 2005, no money was going into the stock market.
Exactly.
And now that it's moved out of the real estate realm, it's into the stock market, and of course we see the rates going higher.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a matter of a pool of money that's sitting on the sideline and waiting to invest. You have on the commercial side, you have companies like the Irvine Company, which is sitting on a gigantic pool of funds, and said, well, let's overpay and buy the best properties we can.
Mm-hmm.
And they've gone out, and you may have noticed that, or read about in the paper in San Diego, they basically have bought every major modern office building in downtown San Diego. And in the long run, they'll do just fine, and they're not terribly worried about it. But the world is completely awash in money.
And that changes the game, because I guess they can afford to have quite a down period and not affect the long-term plan.
Yes. It's sort of interesting as you go back through history. In every decade, there seems to be one foreign group that jumps in and gets taken.
That's right, the designated bag holder.
Yeah, it's very good. Yeah, the Canadians had it one decade. The Japanese had it in the 80s. Right now, we're actually in a period where there doesn't seem to be any one country that's going to hold the bag.
I wondered if it's not the local United States investor who overpurchased, leveraged their own residents to keep on buying things they thought were never going to go down.
Well, the answer is that for the vast majority of America and Americans, that's really not going to happen. And it's more of a California phenomenon than in the rest of the country.
Okay. That's kind of good news.
Well, no, really, when I go, I look at the numbers that come out from, like, the National Association of Realtors, and they'll say that Akron, Ohio is going to be the fastest appreciation in the country, but their median home price is $114,000. Who cares?
That's correct.
You know, they're going to go up 7%. Well, whoopee.
Plus, they have so many foreclosures right now. Their price range is much lower than California, and their foreclosure rate's very high. But maybe they just don't have enough inventory to impact the market.
Well, you have the United States divided into two sectors. One is long-term future growth, and the other is long-term future decline. And if you're anywhere near the Midwest or Northeast, you're looking at a long-term decline. There are some exceptions, but generally speaking, these states in the Midwest and Northeast have lost their basic employment, and they can't turn around. They're gone. They're history.
Not with their current job base. That's correct.
And it's really, it's also a demographic thing, because what happens back there is the minute the kids get out of high school, they leave. And when you look at the median age in the Midwest versus, say, Texas or Florida, there's like a 10-year differential. And that has a very meaningful impact on where jobs will go, because right now in the Midwest, your typical job holder is at the twilight of their career.
Do you view commercial real estate, where cap rates are virtually at all-time lows, do you view that a healthy segment for years to come?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, and the reason is that is rarely highly leveraged. The vast majority of the properties are purchased all cash or with relatively modest leverage.
I didn't know that. Is that because they're owned by REITs and that type of thing?
Precisely.
Okay.
REITs, insurance companies, people like Irvine Company.
Okay. San Diego just had an auction that was held. There were 100 lender-owned properties. That's going to be repeated in this weekend, I think, in Los Angeles and in Riverside. And here's a quote. It said, at the San Diego sale, houses and condos typically sold for about 30% below the previous sale or appraisal. In a few cases, the discounts were around 50%. In your opinion, was having to auction off excess San Diego real estate even considered a remote possibility 2 years ago?
No, but it's certainly part of a cycle.
It is. That's a repetitive thing.
And incidentally, what you have to recognize is that most of those properties, to put it kindly, are dogs.
Okay.
And if you also look, by the way, FHA had an auction as well, and the quality of the properties is really not top flight. And when you say they've sold for 30% off of their highest price, I can believe that, because some were bought irrationally in 2004, 2005, and they never should have sold for those prices. In other words, in today's market, if I look at the overall market in say, San Diego, the residential market, there is this sliver of buyers that bought at the very top of the market, and if they had to sell today, they could take a 10 to 20% hit. And that happened last time as well, by the way.
Sure did.
Oh, and the time before.
Yes.
So some people just buy at the wrong time, but that's not unlike the stock market.
When builders have these cycles, say in 2004, where they literally can build almost anything and somebody wants it, and it turns out that 40% of those people that want it are investors, do they kind of get blindsided by thinking that there's really demand for their future building product, and therefore they get caught with unsold inventory?
No, the builders this time around learned their lesson. We track inventory of new homes, and the average subdivision barely had half a dozen homes unsold. So they're not terribly worried this time around. They discounted them and got rid of them. I mean, it's very unusual to only have half a dozen homes under construction or completed and unsold. You try to usually have a lot more than that, but the builders were skittish, and they did not overbuild.
When someone like Margaret Whelan, who's works with UBS and talks about that we have 2 million unsold properties, and she was referring to about a million of those being owned nationally now by the builders, I was of the impression that the builders had once again repeated the process. You're saying that's not true.
Well, you have to divide the market into detached and attached.
Okay.
On the detached side, the inventory is very minimal. And that's all across the United States. You don't go out like you did in the 80s and where you see Dallas builders sitting with 100 under construction or completed homes that were unsold.
Okay.
If you go out shopping in Southern California today, it is the rare tract that has more than half a dozen units under construction and completed and unsold.
Is it economically feasible to keep, because I know that they're still developing large tracts of land. So if you're a developer and you get, say, a third of the way through your track and sales are going less than expected, is it really feasible just to say, who cares, we'll just hang on to it for a decade?
Yes.
Okay.
No, not a decade, but yes, for a few years. Now, what happens, though, most of the builders buy land with rolling options, and they just drop their options.
I've noticed that they've been dropping their options, but they've been dropping $100 million a month, basically. They've dropped now $2 billion. So looking back, were they too generous with the option money or too optimistic about what the needs were going to be?
Well, they had to keep the machine going. You just can't stop just because the market has a short turnaround.
Do you view that that's what we're in for, is just a short turnaround?
I think we're on the way back to what I consider normalcy. And I completely erase 2004, 2005. If you erase those 2 years, we're in a pretty normal situation.
Okay, so, since those were explosive price years, you probably went up 50% in 2004 and 2005. Are you saying that we really should be picking up a normal markup from 2003 and 2007, which would, to me, literally mean we have a price hit coming?
Well, there's no question at the subdivision level that prices have bottomed out. And what's happening, and this is really a whole different discussion, because land prices are coming down, builders will be able to build smaller homes and sell them for less money.
That's a good point.
And that is what's happening in places like Riverside and the other high-volume markets, and they are bringing the new product. It's typically maybe $100,000 less than the old product, which means it's a hell of a lot more affordable, and that will enable the market to come back quicker than it might if land prices had held.
That's absolutely true, and not only that, we just finished building a tract of homes in Lancaster area about a year ago, and we purposely built the 1,300 and 1,400 square foot home because no one else would, and we had an audience for it. And that inventory will sell in almost any California market, but with the land prices where they were, there was no way you could afford to build it.
Mm-hmm.
So that is true. If land gets cheap enough to where they can do that, that would be a good thing.
And it will.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, in Southern California, you had a situation where land sellers were not only getting maximum price, but they were trying to get, and in several cases did, get participation in the profits of the project to begin with. So it was really an untenable situation.
Well, it brings up a question as far as you're in the advisory position. At some point, let's say in 1996, 97, where real estate's been pretty beat up, and you know, you look into your crystal ball and say, you know, I think things are going to go pretty well for a long time. Why would builders be buying land in 2003 and 4 and 5 when they had the opportunity to pretty much lock up most of Southern California from very willing sellers years before that?
The vast majority of the building in Southern California is by the national public builders.
Correct.
And they march to a different drummer. They are basing their entire existence on getting a rate of return, and they can't afford to go out and buy huge tracts of land because in the public arena, holding land is a liability, not an asset.
Okay.
So they would much rather take rolling options, pay for them, and then in worst case walk, than buy them and have it sitting as a non-producing asset.
Okay. The auction that I mentioned was made up of lender-owned properties, and back in the 90s, those auctions were typically HUD properties. And this cycle, HUD's pretty much disappeared and were replaced with subprime. So in your opinion, did the lending policies of recent years really aid and abet this explosion of price? And did we maybe make loans to way too many people?
Absolutely.
Okay.
There were just people who should not have bought. And it's unfortunate. Now, the reality is that the vast majority had zeroed down, so it's not like it destroyed their estate.
Right, they didn't have an estate.
They didn't have any. The only thing it does, of course, is ruin their credit for a while.
Right.
You know, there is a portion of America that has always been that shouldn't own.
Right, about a third, something
like
that.
One third on the nose. Remember, if you look all around the United States, it's a marvelous economic experiment, because what you see is, even in markets where the home prices are very low, even when things are booming, you have the one-third rent, two-third owned. So it's not that if prices were lower, a lot more renters would buy. There's just a normative percentage that should not be owning property. I say should not. Are in situations that would not make them homeowners who can carry a mortgage on a prolonged basis.
Part of it, and this was interesting, we went to Texas and did some buying because I did some 1031 exchanges out of California at what I thought was the peak of the market. And you had a situation where we were buying houses in Texas for $80,000 that would rent for $1,200, and I really just had to sit down a realtor one day and say, I don't get it. Why would somebody rent this for $1,200 when they can get a 5.75% fixed rate mortgage and have a payment that's less? And his explanation at least made a little sense. He said past history has told them that owning property in Texas isn't so hot, and their job situation changes. And if they had to move in their, once again, using their memory, it's been very costly.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, I guess I could buy that. But in California, of course, if you get to go from renter to owner, you probably just made your retirement one time.
Yes.
There's a group called the Center of Responsible Lending that feel that the lenders were very generous and made loans to people that should have never received them. And they've even suggested that brokers were aiding with the stated income statements. Do you feel that the exaggerated incomes had a big part in making this whole thing get a little out of hand too?
Well, yes, that along with the fact that lenders would accept lower FICO scores.
Correct. And the reason they accepted lower FICO scores was strictly because they could exit the paper successfully in the marketplace?
Absolutely.
Okay. So now that gets to a little bit ahead of ourselves, but now that game has changed. They're not able to exit that paper as easily. So do you view this tightening of credit a very substantial situation that could make this negative scenario play out a little longer or a little harder?
Yes.
Okay.
No, absolutely.
Okay. What surprises me, and we're kind of wrapping up here in the last minute or so, in December of 2005, there was a document that was sent out by a joint committee, and it was entitled Proposed Loan Guidance Change. And so as long as December 2005, there was talk from the people that oversee the lending business that there was needing to be some changes, that they were trying to make sense of why the lenders were loaning to people that didn't prove that they made any money, had any money. The only thing they had was a FICO score sufficient enough.
Right.
Is this the first time in the lending history that you're familiar with that we were that lax on who got to buy something?
Well, not really, because in decades past, there was a tremendous impetus for FHA, VA loan zero down. I mean, that basically would cause the debacle in Texas in the 80s.
It sounds like most of the things that we're talking about are repetitive scenarios.
Every time.
Every time. Okay. We've kind of got to wrap it up for this segment. Alan, thank you for joining us, and we'll pick this up next week.
Thank you.
You bet.
You've been listening to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com or email questions and or comments to radio@thenorrisgroup.com. We'll see you next week at 5:30 here on News Talk 590 KTIE.